Let me just say something about myself first, so that maybe you can cue into what I'm doing more quickly. Coming to Biblical is actually a nostalgic moment for me. I was never, of course, with Biblical, but I have known most of your professors as teachers. And now it is a joy for me to come and join hands with them in this very brief time that I have with you. I come from Singapore, was born there and grew up there, and was a member of the Bible Presbyterian Church, which in Singapore, incidentally, has no organic connections with the Bible Presbyterian Church in this country. Well, I went to Shelton College in 1959 and took my degree in Hebrew and Hellenistics. It seems that most of the schools I've studied under have today disappeared virtually. Or the names still survive, but not the associations I had with them. I was happy to study under Dr. Yamauchi, Edwin Yamauchi, for instance. Some of you might have heard, read his books. And also to have had my first exposure to Greek as early as in 59. At that time, one insisted on classical Greek for 2 years before going to Koine Greek. And that classicist approach has rubbed off in some way, because I was interested in languages from early on, having had Latin as a background before college. Now, I went on to faith between the years 63 to 66 and took studies also at Temple University, and later, because I received a scholarship at faith, it was a scholarship from the University of Pennsylvania, given to seminarians, recommended from the Philadelphia group of seminaries. I was able to complete a master's in history at University of Pennsylvania. Then I went over, after that was 7 years already, I went over to England for further 4 years, did my work under F.F. Bruce at Manchester University. And the system in England is very different from in North America. I was able to concentrate fully on my dissertation, which was on Adam and Christ, an exercise in Pauline studies, which has appeared since in a published form, in the form of a synopsis in a book published by Edmonds last year called Pauline Studies, which was a festschrift in honor of F.F. Bruce's 70th birthday. I was able to travel quite a bit during my time, spending a full year in the British Museum, where took advantage of their excellent facilities, the library facilities, and also spending some time both in Cambridge and Oxford. Then I went home in 1970 to a very varied ministry, pastoral as well as teaching, and since then I've acquired a third portfolio, which was a chaplaincy in a prison. I thank God for a church that is liberal-minded enough, not in its theology, but in its policy to allow me times off, and I'm taking what is called a sabbatical leave. I took the first half of it in 74, at Cambridge, where I worked as a postdoctoral fellow at St. John's and the Faculty of Divinity. That was at a time when C.F.D. Moore had just retired from his Lady Margaret Chair of Divinity. And it was a stimulating time, both at the university in a Tyndale House, where I worked. Now, I'm on my sabbatical leave, which is a period of work, not just a holiday. I have been to various countries preaching and pursuing my interest in missions with the organization known as Operation Mobilization. Some of you might have heard of OM, as it is called, and I've been on the OM committee for about 11 years. I'm due to rejoin the MV Dulos, which is their gospel ship in Mexico, after I complete my work at Biblical. And then I'll be going to Japan for a time of ministry at a Bible college, and with the KGK work, which is the IDF work, at a time also renewing fellowship with my former students. I teach at a postgraduate school in Singapore called the Discipleship Training Center, which was started by Mr. Adeney, and together with the OMF. And we have been training people, especially for Asia. We're thankful for graduates who have gone back into pastoral and mission work in various countries of Asia. Now, my particular field of teaching and studies has been New Testament and Greek. And I'm happy for the opportunity to teach Mark with you, although it has not been easy for me to move through various courses. When I was at Regent College, I taught a course in Romans and Galatians, as well as Greek readings. It was a stimulating time, although I find my experience here at Biblical, I think, will be very different from Regent. Partly because most of the students I had to teach these biblical courses were non-Greek students, but who were very keen and alert students, nevertheless. So it's a good approach for me, and I hope that you will enjoy the experience as much as. But it's necessary for us to work through the course objectives, and so let's start with that. Would you please take the syllabus out, and I'll read through with you quickly. Also, for the sake of those who will be listening to the tape later on, it's good for us to work through these objectives. Now, the objectives of this course is threefold: to formulate an approach to the exegetical study of the Gospels. Notice the general character of this first objective. Secondly, to discover the inner logic of Mark's gospel, noting its peculiarities and, where possible, its place in the synoptic tradition. This is not a course in the synoptics. However, I hope to deal with this matter, and most of you have been alerted to your need to have the synopsis edited by Kurt Allen. So if you do not have this, you will have to use the library copy. May I just find out at this moment how many of you do not have a copy of this? Okay, now you can use the UBS edition, which is a red washable cover edition, but on occasions you find that using this would help to cut down considerably your time, because you can make your observations readily, especially as you are required to observe the similarities and differences between Mark and the other Gospels. So while this is not a course in the synoptics, I will go into it where possible, but our main purpose is to understand Mark, especially the inner logic of the Gospel. I've avoided the use of the term the theological purpose of Mark, because it begs the question. It assumes that Mark had a theology and that it was a fairly coherent or systematic form of theology. I think the term inologic would suffice to show that Mark was not a scissors and paste production, but there is some rationale for the way the materials have been put together. A third objective is to sharpen your skill in Greek exegesis through demonstration and practice. And you will get lots of practice. You cannot be a passive observer in this course, you will find out. Now, how do we achieve these objectives? These are the following methods. There will be 13 1-hour, 40-minute lectures, and I hope to cover the entire gospel, with special attention to certain passages which you will need to translate before they are taken in the class. And the first such passage will be Mark 1:1-13, due on Friday, which means that you'll be starting your exegetical notebook fairly soon. You don't have time to settle down slowly. Those of you who come late to a lecture, please be responsible for what you miss. You will be quizzed on the lectures. I will give you my outline. Now, because the first lecture involves some German words, I have given you a printed outline. However, subsequent lectures will be given, the outline will be given to you orally. Okay? We may have to pause now and then because of the taping, for instance, when we need to change over the tape. The second method to secure these objectives, the three objectives, will be the translation of passages from Mark. You will see on page 3 the passages listed on the fourth column. I've tried to restrict the number of verses for each double session to around 20 verses. You will need to not only translate and pass, but also to annotate your translations with your own observations and with readings from commentaries. Now, I would like you to follow a certain procedure. Turn back, please, to page 1. Pass all words whose forms you cannot identify, even if you know their meaning. For instance, if the state of your Greek is such that you still cannot understand what agenito is, you know it means and it happened, but you cannot tell that it is imperfect. You might think it is aorist, you know. Or you might think it is some other. You might think it is imperfect or aorist or present or some other tense. Even if you can translate that word, but you cannot identify the form, you will need to pass. Okay, now what you can identify, of course, do not pass. Words such as estin or amy or esmen. Now, I do not know what passing sheet you use here, but I prepared a passing sheet which you might want to use. If you have one that is similar, which you prefer to use, go ahead. But I've given you a key to the abbreviation so that we will all use more or less the same abbreviations. For instance, imperative is not IMV as in some usage, but it is IMPV on this key. Okay? It is best to use a standard passing sheet. sorry. Prepare a literal, fluent translation in good modern English. You might think this is unnecessary, but I want to demonstrate to you tomorrow, we will not have time today, using the overhead projector, what I mean by this kind of translation. Do not use archaic Elizabethan English, please. I would like you to use brackets also to bring out the nuances of the Greek. Thirdly, note special uses of tense, idioms, and other features of syntax. I assume that most of you have had your first year of Greek, and that you're well into advanced Greek. Or at least you can identify a conative in perfect, or that you know what an objective genitive is as opposed to a subjective genitive. Now, you may not know what a hendiades is, or an anacoluthon, you know, or a chiasmus, maybe something you've never heard of before. But I hope that the standard terms such as constative aorist and frequentative imperfect, or gnostic aorist, sorry, not gnostic, nomic aorist, would be familiar. Fourthly, compare the Markan text with other Gospels and note significant differences of wording. And then E, refer to at least two commentaries from each of two sections found in the commentaries listed. Now, let's look at the commentary section, please, on page 5. I have placed all these commentaries on reserve. You'll find them in the library. They are classified for you. You might be tempted to read Leng and Excel, but you will get a one-sided approach. I would like you to just choose one commentary from section 1 and one from section 2. Section 2 would involve you in higher criticism. You would have to read what redaction critics or form critics have to say about certain aspects. Now, you may choose which two commentaries to use. And I would suggest that you don't stick to two commentaries all the time. You should dip into various commentaries. But I would like to see some acquaintance with commentary opinion in your annotated translations. And try to keep these five categories separate so that I can look at them fairly quickly when I check your workbooks during the tutorial sessions. Well, talking about the tutorial sessions, there will be four reading assignments. The first two, all four, would involve books which, except for the fourth one perhaps, which would be available in the library. Assignment 1 involves reading six pages only from Howard Marshall's Introduction to New Testament Interpretation. Now, you need not turn in anything written, but I'd like you to keep notes of your reading, because when you see me for the tutorials, I will be asking you questions from the reading to ascertain whether you have understood. Between today and tomorrow, after class, I would like you to sign up for your tutorial sessions. The four tutorial sessions are there. You will need to sign up there and sign up also here. This is my copy, which I will have in my office. And the set that is here in the classroom will remain here. So remember to sign up twice for the tutorials. Now, the tutorials will help me to get to know you as well as to enable you to ask me any questions that you like, not only on the readings, but on the lectures. The second assignment is a little bit more difficult and controversial. It has to do with a problem of historicity and inerrancy. So, as you know, the inerrancy question deals largely with alleged contradictions or errors that are found in the Gospels. And we do not want to avoid these controversial areas in this class. I want to work through some of these areas with you. The third assignment deals with some mat-word in connection with redaction criticism. Now, I don't know whether you are familiar with the term redaction criticism, but I wanted you to have an exercise in redaction criticism, and I'd like to just state at this point that I do not agree with the redaction critical method. But I think one way in which you can see the fallacies of this method is to attempt to try and do an exercise using the principles of redaction criticism. And then you can see for yourselves, hopefully, some of the fallacies of this method. The fourth assignment will help you to see the forest from the trees, hopefully, involving the reading of the entire Gospel of Mark in one sitting. Page 3. Here are my procedures for testing achievement of these course objectives. The quizzes will account for 15% of the final grade, and they will be held every Monday morning, the first thing in the week. I like to begin the week properly. The quizzes will not be on your readings, but they will be on the lectures. And there will be objective quizzes. Your exegetical notebook will account for 45% of your final grade, and the final examination will comprise only context questions. That is to say, I would like you to be familiar with the Gospel of Mark, the text of the Gospel of Mark, because it's a danger in our working through this course that you may know a lot about Mark, but not know Mark itself. And so to correct that, the examination will involve a knowledge of the text. It means that I will be giving you verses from Mark to identify. You will need to know what chapter it comes from, not necessarily the verse, what went before and what went after, who said those words and to whom they were said, etc. And I'd like to find out at this point what version you use. Can I assume that most of you would use King James or NIV? No. All right. No, I know I'm not going to get consensus here, but how many use NIV? Okay. How many? Thank you. King James? All right. What are the other versions that I use? NESB. How many? Oh, quite a good number. Okay. What else? Now, how many who use King James use NESB as well, or NIV? Okay. Now, let's say if I give you the context questions from either the, well, I would have two versions. From the NESB as well as the NIV, would that suffice? Okay, so please plan your reading so that you would be familiar with either of these two versions. Any questions so far? The reading assignments will not be graded. I wanted you to feel relaxed when you come for your tutorials. So you don't feel you're put on You will not be graded on your replies, but how you perform on this might enhance your final grade. It won't detract from it, however. Now, the schedule of the lectures. I remember to say schedule, not schedule. I think it's self-explanatory. Let's move on to page 5, the select bibliography. Now, a bibliography like this is actually meaningless unless it is explained. I will tell you why I have selected these books for use in this course. And in a way, I would like to talk some more about these books. I could spend one whole hour, for instance, on number 2, Kurt Allen's The Greek New Testament. There are things which can be discussed on these, and I was wondering if I could have a separate session with you over tea, perhaps, when we are more relaxed. I could just talk about each of these books systematically, telling you what is important about these books, how you should approach them, especially the commentaries. If you like that, I could do it. I don't have time in the lecture to spend elaborating on this bibliography. Let's begin now with the first lecture. You will need to follow the outline given. Roman numeral 1, general introduction. We start first with capital A, what is a gospel? The term euangelion, the noun form, gospel, meant in the classical period a reward given for bringing good news. It was often a reward in the form of a wreath given to a herald who brought good tidings of a victory that was won. In Hellenistic Greek, New Testament times, the term normally meant oral communication of good news. It had to do with something spoken, good news that was spoken rather than written. And it was often a term used with a pagan background. That was just to say that this is a term specifically linked with the emperor cult. You can say it's a pagan term in Hellenistic Greek. Furthermore, that was point number 1. Point 2, the plural euangelia was never used as, for instance, we would think of the four Gospels, but the good news as such was a singular term. It was a singular noun that was used. So both the noun itself, euangelion, as well as its plural form, had connotations which are quite different from those that we associate with the word today. Point 3. This term, euangelion, was chosen by the New Testament writers to designate their work, despite all these reasons, because of its link with a word which had importance as far as their Greek Bible was concerned, the Septuagint. And that word is the verb form euangelizomai.
The early Christians found this word in their Greek Bible at passages like Isaiah 40 verse 9, 52 verse 7, and other places. For a full discussion of this, refer to F.F. Bruce's article entitled, When is a Gospel Not a Gospel? In the Bulletin of the John Rylands Library, Volume 45, 1963, pages 325 and following. What I'm saying here is that Evangelion came to be an established Christian term primarily through the verb form evangelizomai, which meant to proclaim good news. Point four. The noun form, evangelion, as referring to written good news, with written emphasis, was used for the first time in the New Testament. I'm referring to the first time in the history of the Greek language. We do not have any usage predating the New Testament usage for the meaning written good news. It was used to refer to something that was gathered not willy-nilly or haphazardly, but with certain reasons that was put together into a discernible literary form. It was not something that was characterized as the work of detached historians. And yet, it was a faithful, accurate, and certainly historical piece of work. It was not a writing in which, I'm referring now to Evangelion, in which the evangelists felt themselves to be free to inject their personal viewpoints. If you read the Gospels, you can see how restrained the narratives are, how very bare they tell us about the various incidents. There is no interaction with the narrative, with the incidents, giving approval or disapproval of that sort. But the evangelists remained, in a way, fairly objective in that sense, in giving the synoptic tradition or the gospel tradition as they found them. But still, in spite of this, they left their individual mark on their work, principally because of the choice that they had to make from a wide variety of incidents that could be described. We think of, for instance, the Johannine principle in the fourth gospel. The evangelists certainly were not clutching at straws to try and piece together something from very scanty evidence. They had ample evidence, and they were trying consciously to select what, in their opinion, had bearing on something that they were trying to portray. Point five. Point four refer to the use of Evangelion for the first time as written good news. Who invented this new term? Well, the evidence points to Mark. We can say that Mark was the creator of this new term. There's no evidence in earlier tradition. When we refer to the sayings source known as Q, whether or not there was such a written source, we do not know. But the word Evangelion does not occur in any of the Q material, neither in any of the other supposedly proto-Markan material like proto-Luke or proto-Matthew. But again, these are all very speculative things. But we can say that the evidence points to Mark as the creator of this new term. In fact, when we see the usage in Mark, we find that it is a favorite term with him, occurs frequently. Luke does not use this term at all. That's something significant. Neither in the Gospel nor in Acts does he use this term. John also avoids this term. Now, in two places, for instance, in Mark, we can see how he uses this term. If you have your synopsis with you, turn to page 152 in the synopsis. I'm referring to Mark 8:35. Mark 8:35. Synopsis, page 152. Now, if you have your synopsis, you can look at the Greek page. If you look across the page, you see that the term kai tou euangeliou occurs in Mark, but not in Matthew, Luke, or John. All right, now what does it say? That verse reads, "Whosoever loses his life for my sake and the Gospels will save it." Now, it is a saying source. It is a saying of Jesus that is referred to. And it is significant that Mark uses euangelion, uses this term, where the other gospel writers doesn't use it. And it is because he is giving a saying of Jesus that is not found in the other writers, and perhaps this use is to emphasize that here is a tradition which is not ambiguous, but it is a genuine saying of Jesus that he is reporting. His use of the word euangelion may be to underline, in other words, his the insistence that he's giving a genuine or authentic saying of Jesus. In Mark 10:29 and page 219 in your synopsis, refer to page 219, about two-thirds of the way down, halfway down the page, the term anekken tou euangeliou is found. "Truly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel." Okay, now again the use of this term where the other synoptic writers leave it out. Perhaps also to emphasize authenticity of the Markan tradition. Point six. Now, this term later became accepted by the early church and established itself as part of Christian terminology. So much for this term. Let's move on now to capital B, the study of the Gospels. Sorry to have to use a few German words. How many of you here understand German? Okay. I will not be using too many German words, but there are a few which are important to help us understand more clearly what we are dealing with here in Mark. In the study of the Gospels, we need to distinguish between what is historisk and what is geschichtlich. Now, in the Gospels, Jesus is not seen as a mere historical person.
historicis is the equivalent of the word historical. To say that Mark's gospel is historical might be an equivalent expression as saying that Churchill's account of the Second World War is a historical account. Now, Mark is more significant than that. The word historical does not convey the essence of what we're dealing with. We can say that Jesus in the Gospels is a person whose significance and relevance is undying, ongoing, and that he continues to impinge himself on mankind at all periods of history. It is certainly about a historical person whose relevance is an enduring one. It is not a person whose significance was simply for a certain period of time. Geschichtlich refers to a process in which the relevance of something goes on. Now, there is no good English equivalent of that. And I think we'll have to just leave it at that. That the Gospels speak of a geschichtlich process rather than a historisch process. Point two. Interpretation, principles, and methods. A, small a, it is difficult and well-nigh impossible for us today to look at the written Gospels in the same way in which the first readers looked at them. Almost 2,000 years have separated us from these writings. A whole new culture and milieu has passed. Words which strain at understanding through much, which we have to strain at through at understanding through much study and debate, these words made their impressions readily, quickly, and totally on the first readers. Or they were intended to make their impressions as such. We have been distanced from the meaning of the text by the inexorable march of the centuries and by other factors. Point B. We need, therefore, to recover this loss through a deliberate literary effort that involves careful and correct interpretation based on sound principles and methods. And I will be discussing this with you personally in the first tutorial. Your first assignment, reading assignment, deals with this particular point. Let me just pause for a moment to digress a little on the first point which I made by comparing Christianity with Hinduism. Now, I realize that some of you probably would not be familiar with Hinduism. But in my discussions with Hindus, I've had on occasions to witness to them, I found that they look at the Christian scriptures with somewhat disdain. They feel that if they are worshipping a person, a God who is a historical person, then he must necessarily be finite and be limited. To them, God is not great, or God is not God unless he transcends time. And for that reason, the Hindu pantheon of gods is mythological. They speak about in the Hindu scriptures, you find a lot of legends and myths, and these are highly valued by them because they are myths. So let us not assume, you know, that people always value historical facts as the basis of their faith.
But you can contrast the Christian basis with the Hindu basis in this light. And let me also say that what I'm trying to emphasize in the second point is that it is through a literary effort that we are going to recover the loss which I've spoken about. Now, there are some people who feel that the less one studies, the better it is. Let the Holy Spirit speak to you. Just be dependent upon the Holy Spirit to reveal the meaning to you. Now, I'm not doubting that process, certainly. But I would like to say here that a serious study of the Bible must involve a certain amount of knowledge of literary principles of interpretation. And perhaps those of you who have had a science background, who have not been sufficiently introduced to literature, would have to prepare yourself to look at the scriptures in this way, that we look at the Bible not only using the usual canons of literary criticism, but we see it as also a supernatural book requiring more than just the humanistic literary approach. Now, I move on to point 3.